Anyway, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And I have Bruce here on Skype, and we're going to have a hopefully good conversation about something interesting. What's going on today, Bruce?
Oh, gosh. There's always fun stuff to talk about. I was thinking, just because we're on such a roll for how many months, years now? If we could read something from, imagine this, the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, FAQs.
Well, that's a novel idea, Bruce. And you could write a novel about that idea.
Well, almost. It's sort of already a novel in terms of the sheer volume of content. It's more than enough for a few novels. How about 1325?
All right.
I think I posted it in the previous chat, but I think you have two Skype chats going, so it was probably the one that you're not looking at. So.
Nope, I got it right here.
You got it? Okay, so there's that one. And I always find this just happens to be one of my favorites that I hear often every week or every other week on our Wednesday study group, because Terry Miller, who is fond of this one as I am, often reads paragraph 7 from lesson 189 as a closing meditation for our study group. But I was thinking maybe we could read lesson 189 today and then go into the FAQ. How's that sound?
I would love to do that, Bruce. Okay. And I agree with you that people go to that paragraph 7 and they just say, well, okay, I'm going to put down the book and go. kind of forgetting the first part of that paragraph and,
and the context
down before.
Yeah, but, exactly.
Yeah, perfect. Lesson 189 is really great. And these lessons, these ones that we're in right now, the last 20 lessons of the...
they're just so wonderful, aren't they? The 160s and the 180s in particular, and the 130s and 140s, and well, they're all great, but yeah, some of them are just so loaded with great insights and deep comfort and reminders of, you know, what we really are as one being. And
it's so amazing to me, because when you first read these lessons, and when I first read them, and I had been studying, I had been pretty much practicing Buddhist for 20 years, before I found A Course in Miracles, maybe longer than that, because it was like from 1974, 1973, and I found the course in 2003. So yeah, 30 years. And so I knew all this stuff. I know all this stuff. I've been studying this stuff for years, following Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, the greatest teachings in the world of non-duality and Advaita, whatever. But when I got into The Course in Miracles and I was reading it, I was saying, yep, I know that. Yep, I know that. Mm-hmm, that's true. Yep. And then,
then you move from the theory to the lab, and then it's like, oh, I have to actually apply this? What?
I have to do this. But the thing that's so ironic, Bruce, I thought I was doing it.
Well, of course we do. Of course we do. And then you really start looking honestly at the contents of your mind, and you realize, holy crap, I'm still wandering around this desert island, where starved and thirsty creatures come to die, rather than dining on the sumptuous, exquisite banquet that is really there for us, that is the mind that is not disconnected and is not uncertain, afraid, and lonely, and all that stuff that the Course asks us gently to consider, that maybe we haven't left the desert yet most of the time. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and that was it. I was still suffering. Mm-hmm. I was still miserable. Yeah. It didn't matter, and that's, when it finally hit me, because the thing that Jesus keeps telling us in the Course is, I want you to be happy. I want you to be joyful.
Unconditionally.
Unconditionally peaceful. And I didn't even know what that meant. I couldn't even imagine how that could be. Because even thinking about, like heaven, the whole idea of heaven seemed pretty dang boring. And, everything just seemed so boring about being at peace. And no way could I have ever understood that being at peace was actually being immersed in the richness of what's real, mm-hmm. and not being caught up in the fearful place of the illusion.
Yeah.
I mean, when there's no fear, then everything is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's not that there's no fear. When there's the cause for fear has been removed from the mind. And I think that's what this curriculum asks us to consider, the possibility that rather than having, I was flashing on, quite a few years ago now when I worked for a high tech company in Northern California, one of my colleagues, who worked about every 6 months, 5 or 6 months out of every year, and then traveled the world the other half the year. And he ended up forming an institute for studying peak states, of awareness, that sort of thing. And I actually sent him a little excerpt of something that happened to me once and made his way into his book. And I was just reflecting on, the idea that we tend to think that there's an experience that we can have, and then we go back to, the desert after climbing to the mountaintop. But mountaintops and deserts are not places where most people can set up residence. And I think the Course asks us to, consider that maybe we could actually reside in a place that is sustainably comfortable and peaceful all the time, not just, now and then. But that takes a lot of practice. That takes, tremendous repetition, which is what we've started out our conversation with this morning, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And do you know that Jesus actually describes that state that you're talking about right there? And I'll find it. I'm not sure where it is.
Okay.
But he says, what will happen is that you will you'll come into this place where you're in communion with everything, and this is the way I see it. You are in the total peace of God, and everything is wonderful. And he's talking about being a teacher of God. This is what happens when you're a teacher of God. It may be even in the teacher's manual. And then you will go back out into the world. You'll go back out into the darkness. But you will be the one who's shining the light in the darkness.
Right.
It doesn't mean that you're experiencing the darkness, but he talks about moving from states from where you are in communion with spirit into states where you can actually go out and talk to people and teach and do things.
And he's not talking red states and blue states here,
just
to clarify.
No, he's not talking red states and blue states. I'll find that because it's fascinating. When I read that, I was like, what?
It sounds familiar. Yeah, I think I know which one you're alluding to.
Yeah. So let's look at the and this lesson. I got to say, you're right. Anytime these lessons that they say, like, peace and love and joy abide within me, or I feel the love of God within me now, these kind of things, right when I hear that title, I'm like, no, I don't.
Well, that's the whole point. I mean, that's the brilliant use of cognitive dissonance, which is, a psychological term that I've just dabbled in a few college courses in psychology, and like some people who make a career out of it. But I think that phrase is really helpful, of cognitive dissonance, where, we basically are confronted with something that is so different that it forces us to, in a sense to, well, certainly not forced because we all have free will, but it certainly provides a convincing case for, looking at the choices that we're making, and can be tremendously helpful to get us out of a paradigm that we think that we're stuck in. What comes to mind is something I shared probably before, but with another conversation I had the other day about course-related stuff with Jackie Laura Jones, who has a wonderful program on course-related stuff on Blog Talk Radio twice a week now. And I've been a guest on her show about every other week. Anyway, we're talking about, things that change the paradigm, and I was reflecting on how, in a sense, one of the triggering things for me as an influence was, you know, as a teenager, my mother started getting interested in metaphysics, having kind of put it on the back burner for a number of years. So during my adolescent years, she was, you know, kind of like, what's this, all this world stuff about, and why am I here? And, you know, it's got to be a deeper meaning kind of thing. But what triggered it for her, and what was kind of put on hold for a number of years until, you know, the child rearing was at a point where she could kind of turn her attention back to that a little bit, was when she was a teenager, on Catalina Island off the coast of California, staying with her grandmother, who had a place there. She said she was on the beach and saw what was apparently a whole fleet of UFOs, zooming across the sky, and making a very abrupt right angle turn at high speed, which of course would have ripped the crap out of any conventional aircraft, and then disappeared. And she said if she was hallucinating, it was a mass hallucination because she saw every head on the beach turning, tracking these objects. And so it wasn't just, you know, an isolated hallucination. It was a mass hallucination, at least. So that kind of busted her paradigm open. And then she, you know, became, and still is to this day, fascinated with UFOs and became a, you know, a metaphysical buffet line, person, which, you know, among the hundreds of metaphysical titles in my mom's library in Northern California, you know, as I started getting interested into that, in the early 70s, since you were mentioning your Buddhist background, among those many titles that I was reading and or perusing was A Course in Miracles. And I finally cracked them open, the mid-80s, having heard about them from Marianne Williamson, Jerry Jabulski, and those folks for a few years, and finally said, oh, maybe I should actually, you know, look and see what's in them, kind of thing. And it's like, wow, there's, you know, pretty amazing stuff here, you know. And I read them for a few years and then set them aside. And then 10 years ago, Gary Renard's books, you know, rekindled that mostly dormant interest. And it's like, wow, I didn't realize that this pure non-duality was, and the forgiveness and the whole emphasis on forgiveness and the understanding that God couldn't possibly have had anything to do with space, time, individuality, or the whole thought system of sin, guilt, and fear, because if that was true, then God would be cruel. You know, if this were the real world, God would be cruel. Anyway, but enough of that digression. But I think it's, like you say, it's this, the cognitive dissonance, the things that kind of sometimes are gentle awakenings, but other times we get a little bit of a jolt where the alarm goes off. It's like, oh, sit upright in bed kind of thing. These lessons in some ways very much are, you know, just such stark contrast between the two thought systems. And Jesus in his curriculum goes back and forth countless times between the insanity of the ego and the sanity of the thought system that he's gently and patiently promoting. And we just, you know, get to compare and contrast and just say, he just asks us, is this what you really want? You know? So anyway.
Exactly. Oh my gosh. And what a great thought that is. When I began to realize that it is my choice. Mm-hmm. And asking myself, is this what I really want? At the most crazy junctures, like when, you know, something goes wrong and all of a sudden I'm just getting really furious because the internet is not working or something. And just to be able to stop myself and say, is this how I really want to be? Is this what I really want? And to just recognize, no. Not because somebody's telling me I shouldn't do it, not because the world says that's not right, because it hurts me. I actually have a physical reaction that is unpleasant when I am letting my mind run wild and rampant and thinking these crazy thoughts. But my whole life, I've thought I wanted that. I thought, well, yeah, that's alive. That's feeling real passion, you know.
Real passion, another oxymoron, huh?
I know.
Well, at least in the context of the course's use of the word real, anyway.
Exactly. It's just, you know, really honestly, the being able to question my own thinking and actually recognize that most of the thoughts that are in my mind didn't come from Holy Spirit. In fact, the thoughts I think with the ego are like almost every thought. And so
we've rebranded them, huh? We've scraped off the label and put our own identity sticker on them, right?
Exactly. And I'm thinking it's me, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm the one who cares about this. I'm the one who's worried this is going to happen. When you sit right down and look at it, there's no I that's doing any of those things, because none of those things are actually happening. It's like that's all the illusion. And the what I truly am is unaffected by any of it. So, I mean, there's been a lot of things happening in my life over the last 6 months or 7 months or so that have just been almost like mind numbing from my daughter being sick and just, you know, a lot of things happening around me. And it seems like every day, what used to be to me like, oh, well, that's just, you know, that's just the way it is. And I'm, you know, all these challenges are, you know, just the way everything has to be hard. That's the way the world is. Everything has to be hard. Yeah. But, you know, when Jesus is telling us everything has to be effortless, you don't have to do anything.
Exactly.
All this notion you're doing things, that's what's making it hard.
Yeah. It's the vision of sustainable peace set side by side with ego's, you know, zero star drivel movie that is, you know, titled Numb and Number, that is really just a, you know, a travesty. It's just a farce that we've taken seriously. And the Course just gently reminds us that, you know, this whole cosmological, you know, dream, despite the incredibly convincing special effects that, you know, have made a universe of space and time and matter and energy and bodies and quarks to quasars and everything in between, is like, well, that's just a hologram of enormous proportions with fabulous special effects, but it's a freaking hologram. And we have an alternative reality that is waiting for us that we never left, because we're just dreaming this other one up. And the love of God that is within us, as this lesson suggests, is the reality that shines throughout eternity, and we can return to it. But we have an enormous resistance to that, so we need to be patient with ourselves when we come up against that resistance and just practice, and repetition is a wonderful thing, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting when the things that you're saying, I'm hearing you saying this, you know, it's there, the love of God. This is what this lesson is about. I don't feel it. And that's, right. You know, it's not that I don't feel it. It's, you know, well, why am I lying? I don't. Do you
think we're the home of evil, darkness, and sin, which is what Ken says, you know, right off the bat. He says, you know, he says, you read the lesson title, you think, oh, this is going to be great. And then he starts off the work with, you think you're the home of evil, darkness, and sin. Well, you know, and like he says, how many Course students would, you know, tack that over their front door, you know, welcome to the home of evil, darkness, and sin. You know, not too many, you know, but that's actually, if we're honest with ourselves, what our self-assessment is. And that's why, you know, this unconscious, but unfounded guilt runs our life until we look at it. We don't have to dig it all out at once. We don't have to, you know, hire a backhoe and, you know, go nuts knocking ourselves out trying to exhume it. All we have to do is just look at the thoughts that cross our mind moment to moment and just say, you know, I could see peace instead of this specific thing that I'm judging and condemning with my thoughts right now. I can choose to see this gently as a reminder that I have a choice in my mind of which thought system I want to interpret this with or translate it.
Exactly. And that's what brings it about. It's not the reading and saying I know and understanding and trying to commit to memory. And it's the actual practicing of the things that he's asking us to do. And as we practice these things, we begin to see results. And that's really what's happened is, you know, I begin to see the results of it. And that gives me the, I just remember that the next time. Oh, that I did this and everything was fine. In fact, I do this with my husband all the time because, you know, he's, you know, concerned about money and, he doesn't have
like
a job.
The rest of us.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. but he's not working and in a situation right now where it's a point of discussion. And, you know, so he says, you know, I was awake till 3 o'clock thinking about money. And so I do to him what he does to me. We do this to each other. I say, look, you're just here right now with me. There's nothing, look around you. Everything is perfectly fine. You know, we're in a house. We have food in the refrigerator. We have more riches than 99% of the people in the world right here, right now. You know, and that's even beside the point.
Uh-huh.
We're perfectly fine.
Yeah.
You were perfectly fine at 3 o'clock in the morning. The bankers weren't coming to take the house at 3 o'clock in the morning or no attack was being done.
Yeah.
Everything is just fine right now. And everything has in your history of your life, look back. Have you ever died?
Yeah, and I exactly. And I another quote that comes to mind as you're saying that is a favorite. I think it's paraphrased by Jon Kabat-Zinn from a quote from Mark Twain as something like, "There's been a lot of tragedy in my life, and some of it actually happened."
Exactly.
Well, in truth, the course would suggest none of it actually happened, but that's, you know, more advanced awareness after we practice this quite a bit further.
And the other thing too about all that is that it is my decision to suffer.
Yeah.
It's always my decision to suffer. And so reminding myself of that, you know, if I'm suffering, I'm doing it. And people say, well, don't insult me by telling me I'm doing this to myself. Well, stop and think about it. You know, here's an example. Okay, you're...
You could get crucified for that.
Exactly. You could get crucified for that. You're visiting your friend. You're visiting your sister. You're at your sister's house, and the high school football team has a game. And so your niece is in love with the quarterback of the football team. So you go to the football game, and they lose the game. And you're like, well, you know, they lost. You have no input, no desire for any win or loser other than for your niece and your family. But you're not devastated. But your niece is crying her eyes out.
So let me guess. So she's there in front of the vending machine, banging on it, saying, I just want my quarterback, right?
I just want my quarterback. You're so funny. But the difference between, you know, I can watch the same exact game and not suffer, while the person next to me, because they have an investment in it, can watch that game and then be in tears.
Uh-huh.
It's a choice.
Yeah. I talk about, but we all make those special relationships with everything all the time. And that's why bringing those to awareness becomes so helpful, because when we say, oh, I have a special relationship with this thing that I'm either infatuated with or annoyed with, you know, because special, you know, the classic cliche of our relationship with everything is, you know, very frequently it starts out with a special love and then turns to special hate as soon as the object or person or situation or job or house or you know, pick any specific doesn't meet our needs. So we literally have special relationship with everything as seen by ego's interpretation that, you know, essentially range from suspiciousness to viciousness, and we're sort of suspicious when it's special love that, you know, maybe this won't last, and then when it, we discover it sure doesn't, then it becomes vicious, you know, and maybe not overtly, but there's that condemnation that really is basically a condemnation of our own identity that we're not recognizing, because we don't want to see it as in our mind, and we want to have it projected out, which is the whole point of making up a universe in the first place. Is we have this perfect excuse, except it doesn't work, that suggests that we can point the finger at anything and everything but the seeming separate self that we think we are. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Perfect. And so I think that's a perfect lead in.
Yeah.
The lesson. Do you want to read the lesson?
Sure. Do you want to take turns? This is a fairly long.
Yeah, let's take turns.
Every other paragraph?
Sure,
I'll start out. Lesson 189 is, I feel the love of God within me now. There is a light in you the world cannot perceive, and with its eyes you will not see this light, for you are blinded by the world. Yet you have eyes to see it. It is there for you to look upon. It was not placed in you to be kept hidden from your sight. This light is a reflection of the thought we practice now. To feel the love of God within you is to see the world anew, shining in innocence, alive with hope, and blessed with perfect charity and love.
Wow, that's just what we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wish the eyes are metaphoric that I'm talking about, because, you know, if in truth, you know, eyes don't see, ears don't hear, brains don't think, as Ken points out in some of his lectures, Ken Wapnick, you know, then there's a serious conundrum going on there. But that's because we're asked to consider that maybe we're a mind, and everything else other than that is just a surreal dream that we've made incredibly real with that mind, including physical pain, which we think is physical. We think that if I have a sciatic sensation in my leg from sitting 14 or 16 hours, that I need to do exercises to change those muscles and tendons and ligaments around, and, you know, get the circulation and the nerve, whatever. You know, that's all part of that belief in my mind that those sensations occur in a form that exists outside of me, but I have identified with as a body. You know, so it's, what a crazy setup that is. I mean, if you think about it.
Yeah, well, it's unbelievable. When you think about it, it's unbelievable. And the only way that you can actually know it is to experience it.
Yep.
So, and that's why Jesus, in so many of these lessons, he tells us, you're going to have an experience here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to have an experience. And, you know, I used to keep looking for the experiences. And then I realized that practicing what he's telling you to do brings about these experiences, and you don't even recognize, you know, where it comes from, but you do have these, you know, light. I'm sure you have light experience where, like you're suddenly in another place, but another space. I don't even know how to explain it. I call it a long space. I don't know why I've had this experience quite a bit of my life, but where everything is bright and beautiful. And that's what I was saying before, you know, when you turn off the guilt, when you turn off the investment and the fear, the how beautiful everything is, it's just amazing, because you're not feeling bad about it anymore. So and that's what happens. I mean, this is what he's offering, this is a gift. So I'm going to go to the next paragraph. Who could feel fear in such a world as this? It welcomes you and rejoices that you came and sings your praises as it keeps you safe from every form of danger and of pain. It offers you a warm and gentle home in which to stay a while. It blesses you throughout the day. I think that's interesting that he says to stay a while. It blesses you throughout the day and watches through the night as silent guardian of your holy sleep. It sees salvation in you and protects the light in you in which it sees its own. It offers you its flowers and its snow in thankfulness for your benevolence.
Yeah, it would seem that the stay a while is probably just for our comfort and benefit, among many other things that are metaphors, because we don't think that we're ready to live there. We're not quite ready to move into that awareness. So we just kind of like, well, I'll visit now and then. It'll be like a museum, and I'll look at the objects of art there and say, wow, isn't that interesting? And maybe I'll check it out at a different gallery the next time or something. But we don't really want to live there just yet. We just, you know, like you say, it's an experience. But the ultimate experience that the Course is leading us to is to take all those combined experiences and realize, wow, I really could live here. This is a hospitable place. And I'm just at the antechamber in the lobby, and I haven't really gone into the full experience yet, which is having completely, you know, forsaken the idea that perfect oneness could be forsaken. Anyway, I'll go on. This is the world the love of God reveals. It is so different from the world you see through darkened eyes of malice and fear that one belies the other. Only one can be perceived at all. The other one is wholly meaningless. A world in which forgiveness shines on everything and peace offers its gentle light to everyone is inconceivable to those who see a world of hatred rising from attack, poised to avenge, to murder and destroy. And, you know, sometimes it's not as obvious, but if you just turn on the news or, you know, read emails or look at stuff in any kind of media you can think of and look at the self-interest and see that thought system is, even though the forms are tremendously different and varied, it's all the same insanity. But, you know, there's, as Byron Katie says, you can turn anything and everything around. And certainly the Course advocates doing that, to take anything of the ego and put it on the altar of the mind, look at it with the Holy Spirit and watch it disappear. And it disappears not in terms of the form, but in terms of the identification in our mind. It's almost like the identity hooks and energetic, tapping into is severed at that point, because we're no longer interested in appearing to draw sustenance from a parasitic, cannibalistic kind of a thought system that seems to, you know, avenge, murder, and destroy everything.
Exactly. And it really, you have to disengage from that. I find myself getting caught up so quickly and so easily, you know. Sure. I can just, you know, I can look out my window and, you know, see something that, you know, there's the 4th of July. The 4th of July, my neighbors, which now we don't have little children. We don't have any kids in our house. Mm-hmm. So all we have is a nervous little dog and some cats. We're freaking out. And so my neighbors are shooting off the fireworks. Bam, 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 boom, bam, boom. All, you know, like late into the night, the whole neighborhood, because people here love their fireworks, like everywhere else, I guess. But you know, talk about wanting to avenge and murder and destroy.
Yeah.
Not because, why? Because, you know, they're outside making a lot of noise. Then I get up in the morning and I walk out and there's all this, you know, trash. Because, of course, they're, you know, having, you know, burgers and I don't know what all they're doing out there, but, you know, there's trash in every yard, and I just look at that and, you know, why would that disturb my peace? Why would that even upset me in any way at all? You know, the fact I'm having to walk around and pick up all these little bits of trash out of my yard, you know, it's a joyful thing. But at first it was like, yeah.
And every time you see that trash, it reminds you of those guys with powdered wigs 200 some odd years ago signing this piece of parchment, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. That was my thought. Thank God for those guys.
It's talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
You know, I don't want to digress, but since you brought that up, think about, since, and maybe you know or don't know about Hamilton, the musical.
I know of it. I haven't seen it, but I understand it's pretty tough to get tickets, but from what I've heard.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But you know, I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay.
But I've, you know, heard the whole music of it. I'd love to go.
Oh, Okay. Wow.
But the music and the story and everything is just really, really amazing. And Alexander Hamilton was an amazing, amazing man. The thing that is so beautiful about it is that it came about at a time, you know, Alexander Hamilton is the one who mainly responsible for the actual structure of our government. And I mean, the Federalist Papers, which he wrote the most of, really talked about, you know, how the whole structure of our government, the separation of powers, the all the different things were basically his thoughts that went into this. And of course, you know, the other guys had a lot to say about it too, but he was the guy who developed the structure mainly. And so people know about Alexander Hamilton and what he did. So now comes along this political situation in our country that is like, wait a minute, this is going against all these things. And people wouldn't have even known or have been conscious of how this came about and what is really in the Constitution if they hadn't been watching Hamilton and listening to the music and stuff. So it's like, you know, all of a sudden we get this history lesson about what our government is all about, and then we get this government that is completely opposite.
And where have we seen that cognitive dissonance before? Let me think.
I know. It shows to me that the whole plan of the atonement, based on basically the things that are in the script. I mean, basically it's the script of an illusion, and there's a plan for the atonement. And I think that's part of it, is that, you know, we're being shown the other side of everything. You know, that's what the Holy Spirit does. It shows us through contrast and seeing, you know, instead of, you know, seeing, oh my God, we're lost, everything is terrible, being able to look and say, oh, you know what? It's all happening according to a plan. And I don't need to bother myself with it.
Yeah. Yeah. We need to do our part, but we don't need to worry about everyone else's part. And, right. And our part really is so simple. It's basically, you know, like Ken says, he can distill down those two workbook lessons. You know, I could see peace instead of this, and I'm never upset for the reason I think. And armed with those two thoughts, we can, you know, remember to choose a thought system that is one of sustaining certainty, peace, and kindness, and justice for all.
Exactly, justice for all.
Do you want to read the next one?
Yeah, so we're on paragraph 4 now?
I think so, okay. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yes, because we were avenging, murdering, and destroying there. Mm-hmm. So now, yet is the world of hatred equally unseen and inconceivable, I don't know if you know what that word means, inconceivable to those who feel God's love in them. Their world reflects the quietness and peace that shines in them. The gentleness and innocence they see surrounding them, the joy with which they look out from the endless wells of joy within. What they have felt in them, they look upon and see its sure reflection everywhere. So this is what happens when you become this open channel and clear out, you're not clearing out your wants or how you feel about ice cream or things like that. Doesn't matter. What you're clearing out is your expectations and your intentions and your desires and your fears, all the things that you make decisions on that are complete and total fabrication. There's no reason that you should like ice cream better than yogurt, or those are all just personal things that you think about and attach to the ego personality that you think you are. There is no real you that likes ice cream. But as long as I'm invested in, oh, yes, I'm so special because my favorite's pistachio and that's green. As long as that specialness is attached to this Lynn, then I'm going to look at a world of ice cream and say, you know, this is the only thing I want. Not, and when offered something else, I'm not going to be happy. What Jesus is saying here is, when you get to the place where you don't see any difference between anything, you don't prefer one thing over another. You don't hope for something to happen or not to happen. You just let it be exactly as it is. When you come to that place, excuse me, then you don't see anything. There's nothing that can harm you. I mean, seriously, you know, a guy could walk up to you with a gun and say, you know, I'm going to shoot you. And you say, well, that's an interesting thought. So this is the way it ends, you know, instead of, oh my God, please don't, which I don't know if I could be like Byron Katie. I think I'd probably try to bargain with the guy. But anyway, when that happens though, you don't care. Right. And that's maybe why.
And I think it takes practice to, you know, get us up to that point where we truly are independent. And that's the real freedom that, you know, it goes beyond the liberty that our founding fathers were going for. Because I think they were actually really inspired by the freedom, you know, at least in part. And we have a, you know, at least the potential for using that structure that you were talking about earlier to within which to find the liberty to find the freedom in the mind. But anyway, but yeah, it's a process, isn't it, that we just need to continue to look at the contents of our mind and go forward and
ask the question.
Keep asking the question.
Where did this come from? Why do I even care?
Is this the reality I want? You know?
Yeah.
So should I read the next one?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. What would you see the choice has given you, but learn and do not let your mind forget this law of seeing? You will look upon that which you feel within. If hatred finds a place in your heart, you will perceive a fearful world held cruelly in death's sharp-pointed bony fingers. If you feel the love of God within you, you will look out on a world of mercy and love. And I'm reminded of the movie about the life of Beach Boy Brian Wilson called Love and Mercy. Reading that, which is kind of interesting. That's an interesting movie. It's well done. Yeah, it's good. I've watched it several times because my mom is a total Beach Boys nut.
Oh, I'm sure, because she lived on Catalina Island.
Yeah, that too.
Romance.
Vacation there, anyway.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I just thought about that song when you said Catalina Island.
But
he's saying that it's your choice.
Yeah, it's always a choice.
We
could work our fingers to the bone and get bony fingers or or experience a world of love and mercy by giving that love and mercy out to everyone we meet. And that's the technique, isn't it?
That's it. That's the ticket. Yeah. It's so simple. And every teacher, like I said, every teacher that you go and hear, Rupert Spira, Muji, what they're saying, learn and do not let your mind forget this law of seeing. You will look upon that which you feel within. That's it.
Bingo.
That's all these teachers are telling you. What you see is what you think you are. How you think the world is how you think you are. And if you want to change the structure of the government or change the people in the government because you think they're doing a bad job or whatever, think about what's your basis for that.
Yeah.
I thought about this quite often. What's my basis for thinking this? Do I really think I know how things should be? I don't know.
We're all clueless, huh? And to your earlier comment, I was reminded of a quote that's variously attributed to either Hillel, who's I believe a Jewish prophet, or Anais Nin, who's an author. And it goes something like, I'm going to paraphrase that, you know, we don't see the world as it is. We see it as we are. And I think that's pretty telling, isn't it?
That is exactly it. It is what we see is what we are. Yeah. So let's see. So I'll read the next one in paragraph 6. Today, yay. I like it when he says today. Because he's saying, now we're going to do this now. One of these days I'll do it. Today we pass illusions as we seek to reach what is true in us and feel its all-embracing tenderness, its love which knows us perfect as itself, its sight which is the gift its love bestows on us. We learn the way today. Today. It is as sure as love itself to which it carries us, for its simplicity avoids the snares, the foolish convolutions of the world's apparent reasoning, but serve to hide. And that's it. We're gonna see what it is that we're hiding. Mm-hmm. See what we denied because it's the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
And the next paragraph you can read, and it is the simplest thing in the world you can ever do. So let's just do it today. Jesus say, do it today.
Yeah. Now is as good a time as any, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so he says, simply do this. Be still and lay aside all thoughts of what you are and what God is, all concepts you have learned about the world, all images you hold about yourself. Empty your mind of everything it thinks is either true or false, or good or bad, of every thought it judges worthy, and all the ideas of which it is ashamed. Hold on to nothing. Do not bring with you one thought the past has taught, nor one belief you ever learned before from anything. Forget this world, forget this course, and come with wholly empty hands unto your God. And I always like to remember that he starts that last sentence, which is the sort of finale of that paragraph, with forget this world. If you forget the world, then you can forget the course. But I think the order is, in my mind, important.
Yeah, the order of operation is important.
Exactly.
For sure.
It doesn't obey the commutative or associative laws. I'm forgetting that from my high school.
Yeah.
Something like that, anyway. But, I think we're supposed to, learn through this curriculum to forget the world, forget our belief that this is our only identity, our only reality. And then, when we've done that, we don't need the course, forgetting the course, I think, is obviously has a lot of implications in terms of, forgetting our ideas about what we're studying and learning, and forgetting our belief that we think we understand and have any kind of basis for judgments. One of the places in early part of chapter 21 suggests that our cues for inference are wrong, meaning that's why we stumble around blindly and fall down, and because we're just walking with a freaking blindfold on most of the time, and we which metaphorically is basically saying that we think we know where we're at and what we're doing, but that's why we need guidance, because we still believe this world is real, and until we learn to see it with a gentle smile. And see that, wow, this is just a classroom for which I can heal my mind. We're going to, keep stumbling around and to be patient with ourselves.
Exactly. And like Ken said, as long as you get up in the morning and you look in the mirror and you see a body, you see a face, that's where you're at. That's how you know if there will be a time when you won't think about looking in the mirror, because you'll know what you are. And that's really the point, because as long as we hold on to this world, it's either or. There's neither nor. You cannot have both. You can't have this world and have reality too. And that used to, just drive me crazy because it still kind of does, because I want the world, I want the world.
It's only being having a split mind that's crazy making. If you're of one mind, there's, well, of course, if you're of total ego mind, then you're totally insane. But the usual crazy making that having identified the fact that there, you know, must be a better way, and we're still, you know, we've still got one foot solidly in ego's turf, if not a whole lot more of our identity. And so, yeah, we're gonna, you know, when the, you know, we've got one foot on the boat and the other foot on the dock, and the boat takes off, you know, we, at some point we need to make a decision. Where do we jump back on the dock or the boat, you know?
Or fall in the water. And, you know, that's what you, even keeping your little chinky toe touching, you know, just, I'm just going to hold on to a little bit. I'm going to hold on to my, my, you know, grandbaby. I'm going to hold on to my, you know, whatever it is. And that's what I have this quote from Nisargadatta sitting here. I have a little shrine altar kind of thing I have in my room, and it's Nisargadatta, and he's looking straight at me, and he says, I'm not concerned about what you've given up. I'm concerned about what you're trying to keep. That's it. What is it I want to keep? And that's when he says, lay aside all thoughts of what you are and what God is, mm-hmm. all concepts you've learned about the world, all images you hold about yourself. This is what he's talking about. Empty your mind of everything. Everything it thinks is either true or false or good or bad, or every thought that judges worthy, all the ideas of which it's ashamed, every thought. Give up, not because the thoughts come through. They're not even your own thoughts. These are ego thoughts that are coming through, and we're putting them together to make some kind of a story. Really, none of these thoughts are related to each other. It's all the ego mechanism to keep us involved in the illusion. So as long as I keep involved in the illusion, then I'm going to hold on to all these thoughts. And when I start questioning, is this true or not, I can let it go. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And I was just going to say what we're really being asked to surrender and relinquish is suffering. We're asked to give up the idea of compromise and sacrifice, because that is the foundation. It requires a dualistic foundation, which is the ego's only turf, to have any concept of sacrifice. He's not saying empty your wallet of everything. It's not about the form or the behavior. He's not saying, you know, anything, you know, change your lifestyle or you know, give your, you know, your life savings to a charity or to, you know, or it's not about that. It's, I mean, if we feel inspired to do some of those kinds of things, great, you know, more power to you if you have that capacity, but it's not about giving up anything in the world, because it says, you know, there is no world, the central thought the Course attempts to teach, right? So if there's nothing there, there's nothing to give up, there's nothing to have either. I mean, so it's basically, it's the idea that there's something here that holds value for us is our the source of our misery, which is, as you probably well aware, a pretty Buddhist idea, huh?
It is pretty much so. And I used to get really involved in that idea of suffering and, you know, what is suffering? And, you know, that's, there's a whole, a lot of work about that. But, Trungpa was a little different in his teachings than a lot, I think, because he really did talk about it's all, it is all, in our imaginary, it's imaginary. All suffering is imaginary. Mm-hmm, and like I said, you know, the football game thing, you only suffer if you have an investment.
Yeah.
And so it's giving up that investment. And that's why he said, let go of these things you're invested in. And so, I'm going to read the next paragraph. And this is really my favorite. This paragraph here is really my favorite of this. Because it just blows me away, the first sentence in this paragraph that just, and Dove often says this, these first two sentences, and it just, every time, it just gets me. I'm getting me right now thinking of it.
Uh-huh.
Because he's saying, is it not he who knows the way to you? You need not know the way to him. Your part is simply to allow all obstacles that you have interposed between the Son of God and God the Father to be quietly removed forever. God will do his part in joyful and immediate response. Ask and receive, but do not make demands nor point the way to God by which he should appear to you. That's pretty, yeah, I know people, I've done that myself.
A three-piece suit and very polished shoes with spats and a top hat, right?
No, I have not seen God right now. But I have certainly made demands on God about, oh, you know, gee, God, will you please, you know, heal my brother's cancer and, right. You know, help me win the lottery. And, you know, these are ways I think God should appear to me is by, you know, fixing things in the world. So the way to reach him is to merely let him be. For in that way is your reality proclaimed as well. So this whole, I'm seeking for God, I'm trying to find God, I'm looking for the spirit within me, I'm looking for the God within me, I'm looking for the Christ within me, whatever the heck you think you're doing, stop it. Okay? Stop looking for that stuff.
New heart therapy.
Yes, new heart therapy. Stop it, because he already knows where you are. He knows how to get to you. And the only thing that's keeping me from that contact and access is my investment in the world. The art obstacles that I've interposed. So what are those obstacles between the Son and God the Father? What are those obstacles? And those obstacles, again, are my decision, my thoughts, my opinions, my desires, all the things I think you should be, all the things I think the world should be. I have all these thoughts about order and things, and you know, the thought that my yard shouldn't have litter in it, the thought that, you know, people shouldn't be making noise at night, those are the obstacles to God. And what's the first obstacle to peace? The desire to get rid of it. How do you get rid of peace? By blaming and projecting out grievances. That's how you get rid of peace. And I choose to do that. I choose to do that all the time.
Very
intentional.
I read
a post on Facebook and I'll get pissed off. Right there. I did it.
And I think in one of Ken Wapnick's brilliant commentaries, I remember him saying something to the effect that what the Eastern religions bring, which is the, you know, awareness that this world is illusion, is wonderful, but it's part of the process that A Course in Miracles adds to, which is the idea that the illusion is purposive, that we made it up because we think that we shattered perfect oneness. We think we threw God under the bus. We think that there is a valid foundation for this unconscious guilt, but it's unfounded, and we don't know that it's unfounded until we look at it and look at it with our inner kindness teacher, aka Holy Spirit, aka Jesus of the Course, right? And that, I think that purposive nature of illusion is where A Course in Miracles, you know, makes an enormous contribution, because it basically says we want this. It's not just that, you know, the illusion is there and there's nothing you can do about it, but we made it, we want it, we actually are terrified of letting go. You know, our the last obstacle to peace is the fear of God. We think that God is pissed and is going to, you know, have this conventional formal religious wrath and take it out on us if we go past the curtain in the Hall of Oz, you know. And it's like, no, it's actually just this really gentle awareness that we find we didn't make up a dream that is devastating. Well, another, the dream that we made up that seems to be devastating is a dream. We have to just, you know, open the curtain in our mind to see that it's a dream, and that the terror and the devastation that we were trembling in front of is really just made up. But we wanted to be afraid because we think we pulled off this impossible, because it's so convincing, because we did such a masterful job of making up a universe to hide out in. because we thought we shattered that oneness, and it's so far up the ladder that we don't remember having done that. And we're just
exactly
terrified little kids, you know, not consciously aware of that most of the time, but that's the nature of that ontological guilt.
Well, we're consciously aware of our terror. I think.
Yeah, I think many times.
I think, but we don't know what it's from.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so we blame. That's why we project. We blame, you know, Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin. We blame the neighbors. We blame, you know, the dog. We blame everything that appears to be outside of. But then also we blame ourselves. We look, you know, I'm you know, getting old and my body is breaking down and, you know, I'm not taking good care of myself and I should be eating better and what kind of shampoo am I using?
Yada, yada, yada.
We're like trying to fix it up because we see it as it is crumbling. You know,
right,
it tells us this place is a shabby substitute.
A rotting prison.
A rotting prison. Yeah. So we're looking, that's where we're blaming for our anguish.
Right.
We're blaming the external for our anguish and not looking at the true, the guilt that is the cornerstone of the illusion. And you don't have to look and say, oh, okay, I think I'm guilty because I think I killed God. No, you'll never get there.
Yeah.
You'll never get there with your logical mind, because that is like so bit hair. That is like hidden deeply. But you sure can recognize that I'm killing my brother by breathing his air. I'm killing I'm killing my brothers because I have a refrigerator full of food and they're starving, or they're killing me because they have billions of dollars and I'm losing my house. You know, these are the scapegoats, for that true guilt. But when you look at it, look even at all of those guilts, all of those things that you're believing that you did, and if you can understand that this never could possibly be true, this illusion that we appear to be living in could not possibly be real. And what Jesus is telling us, all we have to do is think that maybe it might not be real. Maybe these thoughts might not be my real thoughts. Just give it a chance. And then allow myself to really listen to, you know, my inner guide, my inner, you call it inner kindness teacher. That's really sweet. My own personal Jesus, whatever it is. Listen to that. And hear that, you know, all you have to do is just stop worrying about this stuff. I got you covered. And you'll remember.
He knows the way to us, huh?
He knows the way, yeah.
Yeah, I like how you emphasize those two sentences, two or three. Because it really is. We don't have to do anything. We just have to get the heck out of the way and look at the obstacles. And I'm reminded of another thing that is in one of Ken's many prolific and wonderful audios that I was inspired by, which is the idea that I think I just derailed my train of thought. It'll come back to me anyway. It was Freud's commentary about the dreams being the royal road to the unconscious, and Ken's commentary on that is, well, the royal road to the unconscious is our waking dreams, the dream that we have of being humans in a three-dimensional world of space and time, and a you know, planet going around a sun and a galaxy and all that. That's the dream that, of course, in Miracles, in a larger context, asks us to look at. That is the royal road to our unconscious, and specifically, we use all those specifics. We use all our special relationships to bring us back to the mind, because without that, as Ken points out eloquently, we wouldn't have a way of getting back to the unconscious guilt. And that is our royal road back to becoming mindful and seeing that it is a truly hopeful, and in fact, it's a done deal. We just need to remember to not lose that hope and that trust, and just, you know, to continue to remember that, you know, the atonement path for us is already there. We don't have to do anything but just get the heck out of the way. But look, exactly. But look at all the specifics that we put in the way, and by our grievances and by our upsets and so forth and so on.
So I'm glad you brought up Freud. I was going to bring up Freud a little while ago too,
yeah, yeah.
Because that is, if it hadn't been for Freud and his work, and what I see is that the Eastern world has, Buddhism, Advaita, all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. where, that's their tradition. And so their children are growing up with this idea from their religion that, this world is not real. Mm-hmm. And, there's Maya and they have all these ideas that they're coming up with that are their culture. Our culture is not like that. Our culture is very based in the world, and the world is real, and God made the world in 7 days, all that kind of stuff. Well,
you got quite a meter to that little prose there.
and it wasn't until Freud came along and said, this unconscious stuff, this stuff is unconscious and projecting, and uh-huh. and if we didn't have that basis of, what's going on in the unconscious, the idea of dreams, the idea of projection, that's what makes it possible for us who have been acculturated to the reality of the world. That's what makes it possible for us to actually look at this course and understand it, is because, we've been given an intellectual discussion of how the subconscious works. Mm-hmm. And so we in our intellectual minds are able to look at that and grasp it. What I'm saying?
Exactly.
It's like we wouldn't have got this. It wouldn't have made any sense to us.
Right. Yeah, and Ken points that out in his work frequently, is that, without the foundational work of Plato and Freud and Shakespeare and quite a few others, we wouldn't have that cultural background, sort of whether it's conscious level or not, but that whole basis for putting the course together, and that's why it came when it did to a couple of psychologists in downtown New York.
That's another Alexander Hamilton thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, doll here in the script. It was, we live forever in terror and fear, and the Holy Spirit came in, and this is just my little story. I don't, I made it up. But the Holy Spirit came in and said, oh, no, we'll put Freud in here, and he'll tell you about your subconscious. And then, then when I give you this Course in Miracles, you'll understand to be able to break free from this thing. So it really is the miracle behind the terror is this, all of this. So it's pretty cool. Okay, so you want to read the next paragraph? And here again, another today. You still there?
Yes. I had muted my microphone just a moment. Thank you.
I thought you had muted your mic.
Thank you. Okay, let's start that over again. So paragraph 9 begins, and so today we do not choose the way in which we go to him, but we do choose to let him come. And with this choice, we rest. And on our quiet hearts and open minds, his love will blaze its pathway of itself. Doesn't sound like there's a lot we need to do, huh?
Oh.
Just sit back in the theater, not physically, because there may be things we need to do in the world, just being normal, but mentally. We can afford to be in a state of relaxation where, so metaphorically, we're, in the theater with Jesus, passing the popcorn back and forth and watching this spectacle and letting that love blaze the pathway of itself. What has not been denied is surely there if it be true and can be surely reached. God knows his son and knows the way to him. He does not need his son to show him how to find his way, which is wonderful. It ties into that previous paragraph beautifully, doesn't it? Through every open door, his love shines outward from its home within and lightens up the world in innocence.
Yeah. Isn't that just so gorgeous?
Mm-hmm. You want to wrap it up for this?
Wrap it up with this. And boy, okay. All right. So this is a prayer as I perceive it. It says, Father, we do not know the way to you, but we have called and you have answered us. We will not interfere. Salvation's ways are not our own, for they belong to you, and it is unto you we look for them. Our hands are open to receive your gifts. We have no thoughts we think apart from you, and cherish no belief of what we are or who created us. Yours is the way that we would find and follow, and we ask but that your will, which is our own as well, be done in us and in the world, that it become a part of heaven now. Amen.
Amen.
You know, I find this interesting, and tell me your perspective, or, you know, if you have ever thought about it. The use of we and I. Because this prayer and all of this is saying we go, we do, we, and like the prayer itself, we're talking about we. A lot of times people say, well, don't say we do this because I don't do that. But in this particular situation, Jesus is saying we all do. We all do, and we all have, and we all will, and it's not just an individual, but yeah. There's a lot of times when I read these things, I will say I to myself, to remember that it's I, but actually I just realized we is the only way. There is no I.
Exactly. Yeah. If it's a seemingly separate self, lowercase I, then, you know, that obviously is not going to get it. But the capital I that really is the synonymous with the we and pure non-duality that the Course leads us back to, you know, really is that authoritative voice that speaks the truth, that doesn't really need or have a question from the perspective that it's speaking from. But we're uncertain, lonely and afraid here in the dream. So we seemingly separate selves, in order to go beyond that identity, using our decision-making faculty, can identify with that collective, all-inclusive identity that the Course asks us to, in a very pragmatic way, by looking at our relationships with everyone and everything, and seeing whether we're coming from a wholly inclusive place or an unholy, exclusive and adversarial place. And so that, you know, that gives us a clue that it is a we, in the sense that because we think that there's more than one of us, you know, and that gives us a way to say everyone is in the same boat here. We're all the same being, dreaming of the exile of separate selves. Dreaming of the belief that there could be, you know, such a thing as an individual, and which, of course, word individuality has the word duality right in it. So there's the clue, right? Our language sometimes gives us these clues.
Absolutely. And wow, you know, I'm just thinking about it. I'm just looking at this and thinking about using the we, and, you know, like they call the royal we. Which means the entire empire. When the British say the royal we, they're talking about the entire empire. If I'm thinking we, I'm thinking the entire sonship. And I'm thinking in terms of if I, instead of just saying I, and just remember that I'm a part of all of us, that we are a we, that your interests and mine are exactly the same, whether or not you or I recognize the form, because the form, our interests have no form. It's all pretty basic stuff. So, you know, I may need a car, you may need a Cadillac. That doesn't make our needs different because we both need the same thing, a way to convey ourselves from one place to another. That's the real need. It has nothing to do with the form that it comes in. So when I'm thinking about the we and I'm thinking in the most humble of terms, the reality of it, that I'm not a separate part. I'm not a separate being. I am a part of you. And what helps me helps you. What helps you helps me. What hurts me hurts you. What hurts you hurts me. If that was my total thinking in this we-ness of us, instead of this I-ness of me, does this make sense? That I would never feel alone or afraid or a stranger.
Yes, yes.
Because I only see that we're the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that feeling, that presence within us more and more frequently, I think is a way to remember that, you know, the idea of being alone in the world, whether or not we're in a, you know, a rock concert with 10,000 people or out in the middle of the desert by ourselves, there is no difference in truth, because that identity is one identity that appears in countless forms that, you know, may appear to be separate or together, but it's the world of appearances that is the isolation. And we haven't forsaken each other, and we haven't forsaken God, which, you know, is sort of be the ultimate collective we, right? Because we're only dreaming that it happened. But no matter how convincing that dream seems to be.
Oh yeah, no, and the dream itself is so attractive.
Oh yeah.
And so that's it. It's that attraction to guilt. It's purposive.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense to the logical mind.
Yeah.
Because the logical mind will tell you that is the wrong way to look at things. That's the wrong way to think. But it's the way it thinks anyway. That's why I want to see people be sinful. I want to see other people be worse than me. When I see other people that are better than me, or I perceive as being better than me in some way or another, I'm going to be suspicious of them and think, you know, well, you Mother Teresa, what you had to have had some better thing going on, or, you know, whatever, you think you're so good. Because I feel bad because I see other people being gooder than me. And it doesn't make sense, but there is no gooder or badder. You know, what you do is what you do. And
you can maybe
pancake batter, and that would help. But you do what you do because it's in the script, not because you have a personal investment in it, or you're personally responsible for it, or it's personally. There is no personal. There's no person. And so I love the thought of being just a we.
Yeah, yeah.
And not negating my own personhood, recognizing that my own personhood is small and stifling, even though I think Lynn is really cool. But
well, it's the Lynn and the Bruce that's gotten us into all this trouble that we think we're in. But it's the we that you know, it's, again, the relationship that we have, not just obviously the two of us, but that we have with everyone that is our, as, you know, Ken was pointing out, you know, extrapolating on Freud's idea of the royal road to the unconscious, that's how we get back in touch with the unity that we never lost. That's what's beyond. And in chapter 31, you know, when it talks in the real alternative, you know, that talks about, you know, that we think we need to go down every single little bucket list of all the offerings the world has until we've exhausted them, and then face the bleak despair, which is a fake, and realize that, you know, there's got to be something beyond that. And I think what makes it easy the process is by developing that awareness and that relationship. Just for example, last night. Our neighbor was renting out his house for a few days, and so he was staying with us. And he said, "Well, why don't we go into town and listen to this band that was here a year ago and or so?" and they were really good, and we did, and they were really good, and I was, you know, my wife and my friend and I the three of us were enjoying this music and the ambiance of the restaurant, and I was thinking, wow, this is kind of the quality that we seek in community, you know, and it takes countless forms, but that, you know, that intimacy or that feeling of connectedness, or, you know, the feeling of being appreciated and accepted and part of something larger than yourself. All those qualities and thoughts are aspects of that perfect oneness that, you know, we just get reflections of in those experiences. That seem to come and go because we think it's contingent on, you know, walking or driving down to the restaurant and being, you know, sitting in a place where we can hear the band playing and this and that and the other. You know, it has nothing to do with those things, although those can be reflections of that decision in the mind. But we can make that decision in the mind at all times. And I think that's where, you know, since we just celebrated Independence Day, that's where the real freedom lies, that, you know, the founders of this country were, you know, so interested in freedom, and certainly the liberty, you know, might be a reflection of that at times, but the truly sustainable, the truly independent, freedom is the freedom of the mind and not the body, that gives us the opportunity to gradually, slowly but surely, shift our identity from form to content, which is to go from bodies to the mind and allow that mind to be connected with the spirit that we all really are. That is our real freedom, isn't it? I mean, that's the I think what we're all looking for is that sense of complete connectedness that is unshakable and unassailable.
And not fearful.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's the most important part of it to me, exactly. Is that absence of fear, that taking away of every thought that, you know, something can harm me. And that's what this lesson is really talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, you will come to a place where you will not have any thought that anything can harm you because you recognize your own innocence.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, that I just think another predecessor, and I can't think of a specific person, but I think there have been people in our, you know, recent planetary history that have maybe just sort of science in general. I think the, you know, the last 1,000 years in particular probably have also been part of that foundation that the Course has laid on. Where the whole idea of logic and reason that the Course in Miracles leverages beautifully, because the ultimate logic is that if we have a choice and we can make that choice and it's independent of circumstances, the logic and the appeal of doing that is truly irresistible. And it's only by hanging on to these beliefs of what we are and what we think we're are and the ideas that we're ashamed of that this lesson talks about, that we hang on to, that defies the real logic that the spirit that this Course is inspired by suggests that we, you know, just take a look at it. Just look at it and see that it's not only insane, but completely illogical, even just from a, you know, a truly dispassionate, objective perspective. The logic of believing in specifics as being a way to find peace is just crazy making. It's just to rest, you know, your foundation on shifting sands in the surf is just not a great idea. You know.
Yes, especially if you don't know how to swim.
That too.
that's beautiful It just is amazing to me that we do have a choice, and I was thinking about this section, which I quote quite often, which is from chapter 4, section 1, and paragraph 13, and it's the one where Jesus talks about he will substitute for your ego if you wish, and that you can leave him in charge of everything. You don't need to worry about anything, And he says, I can be entrusted with your body and your ego, only because this enables you not to be concerned with them and lets me teach you their unimportance. Mm-hmm. And that's so cool. He's saying, you know, you don't have to do anything. I need do nothing. It is an actual fact that if you turn everything over to Jesus, then doesn't matter, you know, how you do that. But, you know, if I try to remember, hey, this is not me doing this. You know, I'm asking the Holy Spirit to help me with this. And, you know, I don't particularly call Jesus, but you know, Holy Spirit, whatever, to do this. You know, and another one of my favorite ones is that when you've learned how to decide with me, you will be like carried, like being carried down a path on a summer day.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to do anything. And actually, if you just let me, I will do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Jesus telling us, Holy Spirit telling us, that they will do everything for us. And it's not because they're going to do everything for us, because it's all the things in the world in the script are already there.
Right.
So we're not even doing this.
We may be the agency that carries out that on the level of form.
Right.
But in terms of the faculty and the mind, when we turn that over to this omniscient, all-loving, completely inclusive vision of innocence that holds everyone in its embrace, that is so freeing. And then that allows us to just, you know, what's the next step, boss?
Exactly.
With this infinitely benevolent boss.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I need do nothing except not interfere. Everything just goes on. And what he says, though, in this is, I need devoted teachers who share my aim of healing the mind. Mm-hmm. And then he says, spirit is far beyond the need of your protection or mine. Remember this. In this world, you need not have tribulation because I have overcome the world. That is why you should be of good cheer. And what he's saying is that he did it. He overcame the world, and so can you.
Right.
And he says, you can do it just like I did it.
And it isn't even a temporal thing. It has nothing to do with time.
No.
It's not like a historical thing that he's referring to. It's basically the world is truly an imaginary belief that has been transcended by that awareness that we took with us into the dream. And this is really just a reminder of that awareness that we all have, that is our metaphoric guide out of the cavern of of doom.
This is the Jesus take the wheel part. See,
that's Jesus take the wheel.
So our time is over, and I'm so grateful to you, Bruce.
Likewise. Next week,
maybe we'll get to that FAC.
Actually, next week I will be in Utah. I'm going to be attending the Foundation for Inner Peace benefit at the monastery that David Hoffmeister and his colleagues are doing. So I'm very much looking forward to that. So I will be with you again two weeks from today.
Very good.
And I just actually, this last few days, I finally upgraded the theme on ACIM blog, and still a work in progress, but I have one of the posts is about that. If anybody wants to join us last minute in Utah for a benefit for the Foundation for Inner Peace, I think it's going to be a blast. And you can read about who's going to be there and all the particulars. And I think there's still plenty of room for people that want to make last minute decision to go. And hope to see you there. And if you are going to be there, shoot me an email through the ACIM blog contact page. So
very cool. All right. Well, thank you,
Lynn.
And have fun in Utah, and we'll be looking forward to hearing about that after.
Sounds great. Thanks again.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye for now.